This is a special report from CBS News. The State of the World, the President's Report. From Washington, CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite.
Good evening. Tonight, in this time of crisis in American foreign policy, CBS devotes 2 full hours to the world situation. In a few moments, President Gerald Ford will deliver his State of the World address to a joint meeting of the Congress. CBS News, in keeping with our policy of presenting different viewpoints on matters of national concern, will then present 2 groups of distinguished citizens, one of foreign policy experts outside of the government, the other group members of Congress, and will also present a debate between supporters and opponents of the President's positions on foreign policy. First, however, to the chamber of the House of Representatives, where in just a moment the President of the United States will be introduced to this joint session of House and Senate. It has gathered the two bodies in just the last few moments. Members of the Diplomatic Corps have joined the members of the House and the Senate on the floor, as have the members of the Cabinet and of the Supreme Court. And up in the visitors and galleries, and a place of honor, of course, Mrs. Ford and 2 of the Ford children. The housekeeper, James T. Malloy, in just a moment will be stepping through that door and announcing the president. It appears that he is outside the door even as we speak now.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
Of the Congress, I have the distinct privilege and high personal honor of presenting to you the President of the United States.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, distinguished guests, my very good friends in the Congress and fellow Americans. I stand before you tonight after many agonizing hours in very solemn prayers for guidance by the Almighty. In my report on the State of the Union in January, I concentrated on two subjects which were uppermost in the minds of the American people: urgent actions for the recovery of our economy and a comprehensive program to make the United States independent of foreign sources of energy. I thank the Congress for the action that it has taken thus far in my response for economic recommendations. I look forward to early approval of a national energy program to meet our country's long-range and emergency needs in the field of energy. Tonight, it is my purpose to review our relations with the rest of the world. In the spirit of candor and consultation, which I have sought to maintain with my former colleagues and with our countrymen from the time that I took office. It is the first priority of my presidency to sustain and strengthen the mutual trust and respect which must exist among Americans and their government if we are to deal successfully with the challenges confronting us both at home and abroad. The leadership of the United States of America since the end of World War II has sustained and advanced the security, well-being, and freedom of millions of human beings besides ourselves. Despite some setbacks, despite some mistakes, the United States has made peace a real prospect for us and for all nations. I know firsthand that the Congress has been a partner in the development and in the support of American foreign policy, which five presidents before me have carried forward, with changes, of course, but not of destination. The course which our country chooses in the world today has never been of greater significance for ourselves as a nation and for all mankind. We build from a solid foundation. Our alliances with great industrial democracies in Europe, North America, and Japan remain strong, with a greater degree of consultation and equity than ever before. With the Soviet Union, we have moved across a broad front toward a more stable, if still competitive, relationship. We have begun to control the spiral of strategic nuclear armaments. After two decades of mutual estrangement, we have achieved an historic opening with the People's Republic of China. In the best American tradition, we have committed, often with striking success, our influence and good offices to help contain conflicts and settle disputes in many, many regions of the world. We have, for example, helped the parties of the Middle East take the first steps toward living with one another in peace. We have opened a new dialogue with Latin America, looking toward a healthier hemispheric partnership. We are developing closer relations with the nations of Africa. We have exercised international leadership on the great new issues of our interdependent world, such as energy, food, environment, and the law of the sea. The American people can be proud of what their nation has achieved and helped others to accomplish. But we have, from time to time, suffered setbacks and disappointments in foreign policy. Some were events over which we had no control. Some were difficulties we imposed upon ourselves. We live in a time of testing and of a time of change. Our world, a world of economic uncertainty, political unrest, and threats to the peace, does not allow us the luxury of abdication or domestic discord. I recall quite vividly the words of President Truman to the Congress when the United States faced a far greater challenge at the end of the Second World War. If I might quote, "If we falter in our leadership, we may endanger the peace of the world, and we shall surely endanger the welfare of this nation," end quote. President Truman's resolution must guide us today. Our purpose is not to point the finger of blame, but to build upon our many successes, to repair damage where we find it, to recover our balance, to move ahead as a united people. Tonight is a time for straight talk among friends about where we stand and where we are going. A vast human tragedy has befallen our friends in Vietnam and Cambodia. Tonight, I shall not talk only of obligations arising from legal documents. Who can forget the enormous sacrifices of blood, dedication, and treasure that we made in Vietnam? Under 5 presidents and 12 Congresses, the United States was engaged in Indochina. Millions of Americans served, thousands died, and many more were wounded, imprisoned, or lost. Over $150 billion have been appropriated for that war by the Congress of the United States. And after years of effort, we negotiated, under the most difficult circumstances, a settlement which made it possible for us to remove our military forces and bring home with pride our American prisoners. This settlement, if its terms had been adhered to, would have permitted our South Vietnamese ally, with our material and moral support, to maintain its security and rebuild after 2 decades of war. The chances for an enduring peace after the last American fighting man left Vietnam in 1973 rested on 2 publicly stated premises. First, that if necessary, the United States would help sustain the terms of the Paris Accords it signed 2 years ago. And second, that the United States would provide adequate economic and military assistance to South Vietnam. Let us refresh our memories for just a moment. The universal consensus in the United States at that time, late 1972, was that if we could end our own involvement and obtain the release of our prisoners, we would provide adequate material support to South Vietnam. The North Vietnamese, from the moment they signed the Paris Accords, systematically violated the ceasefire and other provisions of that agreement, flagrantly disregarding the ban on the infiltration of troops. The North Vietnamese illegally introduced over 350,000 men into the South. in direct violation of the agreement. They sent in the most modern equipment in massive amounts. Meanwhile, they continued to receive large quantities of supplies and arms from their friends. In the face of this situation, the United States, torn as it was by the emotion of a decade of war, was unable to respond. We deprived ourselves by law of the ability to enforce the agreement, thus giving North Vietnam assurance that it could violate that agreement with impunity. Next, we reduced our economic and arms aid to South Vietnam. Finally, we signaled our increasing reluctance to give any support to that nation struggling for its survival. Encouraged by these developments, the North Vietnamese in recent months began sending even their reserve divisions into South Vietnam. Some 20 divisions, virtually their entire army, are now in South Vietnam. The government of South Vietnam, uncertain of further American assistance, hastily ordered a strategic withdrawal to more defensible positions. This extremely difficult maneuver, decided upon without consultations, was poorly executed, hampered by floods of refugees, and thus led to panic. The results are painfully obvious and profoundly moving. In my first public comment on this tragic development, I called for a new sense of national unity and purpose. I said I would not engage in recriminations or attempts to assess the blame. I reiterate that tonight. In the same spirit, I welcome the statement of the distinguished majority leader of the United States Senate earlier this week, and I quote, "It's time for the Congress and the President to work together in the area of foreign as well as domestic policy," end quote. So let's start afresh. I am here to work with the Congress in the conduct of foreign affairs, presidential initiative, and ability to act swiftly in emergencies are essential to our national interest. With respect to North Vietnam, I call upon Hanoi and ask the Congress to join with me in this call to cease military operations immediately and to honor the terms of the Paris Agreement. The United States is urgently requesting the signatories of the Paris Conference to meet their obligations to use their influence to halt the fighting and to enforce the 1973 Accords. Diplomatic notes to this effect have been sent to all members of the Paris Conference, including the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China. The situation in South Vietnam and Cambodia has reached a critical phase, requiring immediate and positive decisions by this government. The options before us are few, and the time is very short. On the one hand, the United States could do nothing more. Let the government of South Vietnam save itself and what is left of its territory, if it can. Let those South Vietnamese civilians who have worked with us for a decade or more save their lives and their families if they can. In short, shut our eyes and wash our hands of the whole affair, if we can. Or on the other hand, I could ask the Congress for authority to enforce the Paris Accords with our troops, in our tanks, in our aircraft, in our artillery, and carry the war to the enemy. There are two narrower options. First, stick with my January request that Congress appropriate $300 million for military assistance for South Vietnam and seek additional funds for economic and humanitarian purposes. Or increase my requests for both emergency military and humanitarian assistance to levels which, by best estimates, might enable the South Vietnamese to stem the onrushing aggression, to stabilize the military situation, permit the choice or chance of a negotiated political settlement between the North and South Vietnamese, and if the very worst were to happen, at least allow the orderly evacuation of Americans and endangered South Vietnamese to places of safety. Let me now state my considerations and my conclusions. I have received a full report from General Wyan, whom I sent to Vietnam to assess the situation. He advises that the current military situation is very critical, but that South Vietnam is continuing to defend itself with the resources available. However, he feels that if there is to be any chance of success for their defense plan, South Vietnam needs urgently an additional $722 million in very specific military supplies from the United States. In my judgment, a stabilization of the military situation offers the best opportunity for a political solution. I must, of course, as I think each of you would, consider the safety of nearly 6,000 Americans who remain in South Vietnam and tens of thousands of South Vietnamese employees of the United States government, of news agencies, of contractors and businesses for many years, whose lives, with their dependents, are in very grave peril. There are tens of thousands of other South Vietnamese intellectuals, professors, teachers, editors, and opinion leaders who have supported the South Vietnamese cause and the alliance with the United States, to whom we have a profound moral obligation. I am also mindful of our posture towards the rest of the world, and particularly of our future relations with the free nations of Asia. These nations must not think for a minute that the United States is pulling out on them or intends to abandon them to aggression. I have therefore concluded that the national interests of the United States and the cause of world stability require that we continue to give both military and humanitarian assistance to the South Vietnamese. Assistance to South Vietnam at this stage must be swift and adequate. Drift and indecision invite far deeper disaster. The sums I have requested before the major North Vietnamese offensive and the sudden South Vietnamese retreat are obviously inadequate. Half-hearted action would be worse than none. We must act together and act decisively. I am therefore asking the Congress to appropriate without delay $722 million for emergency military assistance and an initial sum of $250 million for economic and humanitarian aid for South Vietnam. The situation in South Vietnam is changing very rapidly, and the need for emergency food, medicine, and refugee relief is growing by the hour. I will work with the Congress in the days ahead to develop humanitarian assistance to meet these very pressing needs. Fundamental decency requires that we do everything in our power to ease the misery and the pain of the monumental human crisis which has befallen the people of Vietnam. Millions have fled in the face of the communist onslaught and are now homeless and are now destitute. I hereby pledge in the name of the American people that the United States will make a maximum humanitarian effort to help care for and feed these hopeless victims. And now I ask the Congress to clarify immediately its restrictions on the use of U.S. military forces in Southeast Asia for the limited purposes of protecting American lives by ensuring their evacuation if this should be necessary. And I also ask prompt revision of the law to cover those Vietnamese to whom we have a very special obligation and whose lives may be endangered should the worst come to pass. I hope that this authority will never have to be used. But if it's needed, there will be no time for congressional debate. Because of the gravity of the situation, I ask the Congress to complete action on all of these measures not later than April 19th. In Cambodia, the situation is tragic. The United States and the Cambodian government have each made major efforts over a long period and through many channels to end that conflict. But because of their military successes, steady external support, and their awareness of American legal restrictions, the communist side has shown no interest in negotiation, compromise, or a political solution. And yet, for the past 3 months, the beleaguered people of Phnom Penh have fought on, hoping against hope that the United States would not desert them, but instead provide the arms and ammunition they so badly needed. I have received a moving letter from the new acting president of Cambodia, Sakham Koy, and let me quote it for you. Dear Mr. President, he wrote, as the American Congress reconvenes to reconsider your urgent request for supplemental assistance for the Khmer Republic, I appeal to you to convey to the American legislators our plea not to deny these vital resources to us. if a non-military solution is to emerge from this tragic five-year-old conflict. To find a peaceful end to the conflict, we need time. I do not know how much time, but we all fully realize that the agony of the Khmer people cannot and must not go on much longer. However, for the immediate future, we need the rice to feed the hungry and the ammunition and the weapons to defend ourselves against those who want to impose their will by force. A denial by the American people of the means for us to carry on will leave us no alternative but inevitably abandoning our search for a solution which will give our citizens some freedom of choice as to their future. For a number of years now, the Cambodian people have placed their trust in America. I cannot believe that this confidence was misplaced, and that suddenly America will deny us the means which might give us a chance to find an acceptable solution to our conflict." End quote. This letter speaks for itself. In January, I requested food and ammunition for the brave Cambodians. And I regret to say that, as of this evening, it may be soon too late. Members of the Congress, my fellow Americans, this moment of tragedy for Indochina is a time of trial for us. It's a time for national resolve. It has been said that the United States is overextended, that we have too many commitments too far from home, that we must re-examine what our truly vital interests are and shape our strategy to conform to them. I find no fault with this as a theory, but in the real world, such a course must be pursued carefully and in close coordination with solid progress toward overall reduction in worldwide tensions. We cannot, in the meantime, abandon our friends while our adversaries support and encourage theirs. We cannot dismantle our defenses, our diplomacy, or our intelligence capability while others increase and strengthen theirs. Let us put an end to self-inflicted wounds. Let us remember that our national unity is a most priceless asset. Let us deny our adversaries the satisfaction of using Vietnam to pit Americans against Americans. At this moment, the United States must present to the world a united front. Above all, let's keep events in Southeast Asia in their proper perspective. The security and the progress of hundreds of millions of people everywhere depend importantly on us. Let no potential adversary believe that our difficulties or our debates mean a slackening of our national will. We will stand by our friends. We will honor our commitments. And we will uphold our country's principles. The American people know that our strength, our authority, and our leadership have helped prevent a third world war for more than a generation. We will not shrink from this duty in the decades ahead. And let me now review with you the basic elements of our foreign policy, speaking candidly about our strengths and some of our difficulties. We must first of all face the fact that what has happened in Indochina has disquieted many of our friends, especially in Asia. We must deal with this situation promptly and firmly. To this end, I have already scheduled meetings with the leaders of Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, and Indonesia. And I expect to meet with the leaders of other Asian countries as well. A key country in this respect is Japan. The warm welcome I received in Japan last November vividly symbolized for both our peoples the friendship and the solidarity of this extraordinary partnership. I look forward, as I'm sure all of you do, with very special pleasure to welcoming the Emperor when he visits the United States later this year. We consider our security treaty with Japan the cornerstone of stability in the vast reaches of Asia and the Pacific. Our relations are crucial to our mutual well-being. Together, we are working energetically on the international multilateral agenda in trade, energy, and food. We will continue the process of strengthening our friendship, mutual security, and prosperity. Also, of course, of fundamental importance is our mutual security relationship with the Republic of Korea, which I reaffirmed on my recent visit. Our relations with Europe have never been stronger. There are no peoples with whom America's destiny has been more closely linked. There are no peoples whose friendship and cooperation are more needed for the future. For none of the members of the Atlantic community can be secure, none can prosper, none can advance unless we all do so together. More than ever, these times demand our close collaboration. In order to maintain the secure anchor of our common security in this time of international riptides, to work together on the promising negotiations with our potential adversaries, to pool our energies on the great new economic challenge that faces us. In addition to this traditional agenda, there are new problems involving energy, raw materials, and the environment. The Atlantic nations face many and complex negotiations and decisions. It is time to take stock, to consult on our future, to affirm once again our cohesion and our common destiny. I therefore expect to join with the other leaders of the Atlantic Alliance at a Western summit in the very near future. Before this NATO meeting, I earnestly ask the Congress to weigh the broader considerations and consequences of its past actions on the complex Greek-Turkish dispute over Cyprus. Our foreign policy cannot be simply a collection of special economic or ethnic or ideological interests. There must be a deep concern for the overall design of our international actions. To achieve this design for peace and to assure that our individual acts have some coherence, the executive must have some flexibility in the conduct of foreign policy. United States military assistance to an old and faithful ally, Turkey, has been cut off by action of the Congress. This has imposed an embargo on military purchases by Turkey, extending even to items already paid for, an unprecedented act against a friend. These moves, I know, were sincerely intended to influence Turkey's in the Cyprus negotiations. I deeply share the concern of many citizens for the immense human suffering on Cyprus. I sympathize with the new democratic government in Greece. We are continuing our earnest efforts to find equitable solutions to the problems which exist between Greece and Turkey. But the results of the congressional action has been to block progress towards reconciliation, thereby prolonging the suffering on Cyprus, to complicate our ability to promote successful negotiations, to increase the danger of a broader conflict. Our long-standing relationship with Turkey is not simply a favor to Turkey. It is a clear and essential mutual interest. Turkey lies on the rim of the Soviet Union and at the gates of the Middle East. It is vital to the security of the Eastern Mediterranean, the southern flank of Western Europe, and the collective security of the Western Alliance. Our U.S. military bases in Turkey are as critical to our own security as they are to the defense of NATO. I therefore call upon the Congress to lift the American arms embargo against our Turkish ally by passing the bipartisan Mansfield-Scott bill now before the Senate. Only this will enable us to work with Greece and Turkey to resolve the differences between our allies. I accept, and indeed welcome, the bill's requirement for monthly reports to the Congress on progress toward a Cyprus settlement. But unless this is done with dispatch, forces may be set in motion within and between the two nations, which could not be reversed. At the same time, in order to strengthen the democratic government of Greece and to reaffirm our traditional ties with the people of Greece, we are actively discussing a program of economic and military assistance with them. We will shortly be submitting specific requests to the Congress in this regard. A vital element of our foreign policy is our relationship with the developing countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. These countries must know that America is a concerned friend, reliable both in word and deed. As evidence of this friendship, I urge the Congress to reconsider one provision of the 1974 Trade Act, which has had an unfortunate and unintended impact on our relations with Latin America, where we have such a long tie of friendship and cooperation. Under this legislation, all members of OPEC were excluded from our generalized system of trade preferences. This unfortunately punished two South American friends, Ecuador and Venezuela, as well as other OPEC nations such as Nigeria and Indonesia, none of which participated in last year's oil embargo. This exclusion has seriously complicated our new dialogue with our friends in this hemisphere. I therefore endorse the amendments which have been introduced in the Congress to provide executive authority to waive those restrictions on the Trade Act that are incompatible with our national interest. The interests of America, as well as our allies, are vitally affected by what happens in the Middle East. So long as the state of tension continues, it threatens military crisis, the weakening of our alliances, the stability of the world economy, and confrontation with the nuclear superpowers. These are intolerable risks. Because we are in the unique position of being able to deal with all the parties, we have, at their request, been engaged for the past year and a half in the peacemaking effort unparalleled in the history of the region. Our policy has brought remarkable successes on the road to peace. Last year, two major disengagement agreements were negotiated and implemented with our help. For the first time in 30 years, a process of negotiation on the basic political issues was begun and is continuing. Unfortunately, the latest efforts to reach a further interim agreement between Israel and Egypt have been suspended. The issues dividing the parties are vital to them and not amenable to easy and too quick solutions. However, the United States will not be discouraged. The momentum toward peace that has been achieved over the last 18 months must and will be maintained. The active role of the United States must and will be continued. The drift toward war must and will be prevented. I pledge the United States to a major effort for peace in the Middle East, an effort which I know has the solid support of the American people and their Congress. We are now examining how best to proceed. We have agreed in principle to reconvene the Geneva Conference. We are prepared as well to explore other forms. The United States will move ahead on whatever course looks most promising, either towards an overall settlement or interim agreements, should the parties themselves desire them. We will not accept stagnation or stalemate, with all its attendant risks to peace and prosperity and to our relations in and outside of the region. The national interest and national security require as well that we reduce the dangers of war. We shall strive to do so by continuing to improve our relations with potential adversaries. The United States and the Soviet Union share an interest in lessening tensions and building a more stable relationship. During this process, we have never had any illusions. We know that we are dealing with a nation that reflects different principles and is our competitors in many parts of the globe. Through a combination of firmness and flexibility, the United States in recent years laid the basis of a more reliable relationship founded on mutual interest and mutual restraint. But we cannot expect the Soviet Union to show restraint in the face of the United States' weakness or irresolution. As long as I'm president, America will maintain its strength, its alliances, and its principles as a prerequisite to a more peaceful planet. As long as I'm president, we will not permit detente to become a license to fish in troubled waters. Detente must be, and I trust will be, a two-way relationship. Central to U.S.-Soviet relations today is the critical negotiation to control strategic nuclear weapons. We hope to turn the Vladivostok agreements into a final agreement this year, at the time of General Secretary Brezhnev's visit to the United States. Such an agreement would for the first time put a ceiling on the strategic arms race. It would mark a turning point in post-war history and would be a crucial step in lifting from mankind the threat of nuclear war. Our use of trade and economic sanctions as weapons to alter the internal conduct of other nations must also be seriously re-examined. However well-intentioned the goals, the fact is that some of our recent actions in the economic field have been self-defeating. They are not achieving the objectives intended by the Congress, and they have damaged our foreign policy. The Trade Act of 1974 prohibits most favored nation treatment, credit, and investment guarantees and commercial agreements with the Soviet Union, so long as their immigration policies fail to meet our criteria. The Soviet Union has therefore refused to put into effect the important 1972 trade agreement between our two countries. As a result, Western Europe and Japan have stepped into the breach. Those countries have extended credits to the Soviet Union exceeding $8 billion in the last 6 months. These are economic opportunities, jobs and business, which could have gone to Americans. There should be no illusions about the nature of the Soviet system, but there should be no illusions about how to deal with it. Our belief in the right of peoples of the world freely to emigrate has been well demonstrated. This legislation, however, not only harmed our relations with the Soviet Union, but seriously complicated the prospects of those seeking to emigrate. The favorable trend, aided by quiet diplomacy, by which emigration increased from 400 in 1968 to over 33,000 in 1973, has been seriously set back. Remedial legislation is urgently needed in our national interest. With the People's Republic of China, we are firmly fixed on the course set forth in the Shanghai Communique. Stability in Asia and the world require our constructive relations with one-fourth of the human race. After two decades of mutual isolation and hostility, we have in recent years built a promising foundation. Deep differences in our philosophy and social systems will endure, but so should our mutual long-term interests and the goals to which our countries have jointly subscribed in Shanghai. I will visit China later this year to reaffirm these interests and to accelerate the improvement in our relations. And I was glad to welcome the distinguished speaker and the distinguished minority leader of the House back today from their constructive visit to the People's Republic of China. Let me talk about new challenges. The issues I've discussed are the most pressing of the traditional agenda on foreign policy, but ahead of us also is a vast new agenda of issues in an interdependent world. The United States, with its economic power, its technology, its zest for new horizons, is the acknowledged world leader in dealing with many of these challenges. If this is a moment of uncertainty in the world, it is even more a moment of rare opportunity. We are summoned to meet one of man's most basic challenges, hunger. At the World Food Conference last November in Rome, the United States outlined a comprehensive program to close the ominous gap between population growth and food production over the long term. Our technological skill and our enormous productive capacity are crucial to accomplishing this task. The old order in trade, finance, and raw materials is changing, and American leadership is needed in the creation of new institutions and practices for worldwide prosperity and progress. The world's oceans, with their immense resources and strategic importance, must become areas of cooperation rather than conflict. American policy is directed to that end. Technology must be harnessed to the service of mankind while protecting the environment. This, too, is an arena for American leadership. The interests and the aspirations of the developed and developing nations must be reconciled in a manner that is both realistic and humane. This is our goal in this new era. One of the finest success stories in our foreign policy is our cooperative effort with other major energy-consuming nations. In little more than a year, together with our partners, we have created the International Energy Agency. We have negotiated an emergency sharing arrangement, which helps to reduce the dangers of an embargo. We have launched major international conservation efforts. We have developed a massive program for the development of alternative sources of energy. But the fate of all of these programs depends crucially on what we do at home. Every month that passes brings us closer to the day when we will be dependent on imported energy for 50% of our requirements. A new embargo under these conditions could have a devastating impact on jobs, industrial expansion, and inflation at home. Our economy cannot be left to the mercy of decisions over which we have no control, and I call upon the Congress to act affirmatively. In a world where information is power, a vital element of our national security lies in our intelligence services. They are essential to our nation's security in peace as in war. Americans can be grateful for the important but largely unsung contributions and achievements of the intelligence services of this nation. It is entirely proper that this system be subject to congressional review. But a sensationalized public debate over legitimate intelligence activities is a disservice to this nation and a threat to our intelligence system. It ties our hands while our potential enemies operate with secrecy, with skill, and with vast resources. Any investigation must be conducted with maximum discretion and dispatch to avoid crippling a vital national institution. Let me speak quite frankly to some in this chamber, and perhaps to some not in this chamber. The Central Intelligence Agency has been of maximum importance to presidents before me. The Central Intelligence Agency has been of maximum importance to me. The Central Intelligence Agency and its associated intelligence organizations could be of maximum importance to some of you in this audience who might be president at some later date. I think it would be catastrophic for the Congress or anyone else to destroy the usefulness by dismantling, in effect, our intelligence systems upon which we rest so heavily. As Congress oversees intelligence activities, it must, of course, organize itself to do so in a responsible way. It has been traditional for the executive to consult with the Congress through specially protected procedures that safeguard essential secrets. But recently, some of those procedures have been altered in a way that makes the protection of vital information very, very difficult. I will say to the leaders of the Congress, the House, and the Senate that I will work with them to devise procedures which will meet the needs of the Congress for review of intelligence agency activities and the needs of the nation for an effective intelligence service. Underlying any successful foreign policy is the strength and the credibility of our defense posture. We are strong and we are ready and we intend to remain so. Improvement of relations with adversaries does not mean any relaxation of our national vigilance. On the contrary, it is the firm maintenance of both strength and vigilance that makes possible steady progress toward a safer and a more peaceful world. The national security budget that I have submitted is the minimum the United States needs in this critical hour. The Congress should review it carefully, and I know it will. But it is my considered judgment that any significant reduction, revision would endanger our national security and thus jeopardize the peace. Let no ally doubt our determination to maintain a defense second to none, and let no adversary be tempted to test our readiness or our resolve. History is testing us today. We cannot afford indecision, disunity, or disarray in the conduct of our foreign affairs. You and I can resolve here and now that this nation shall move ahead with wisdom, with assurance, and with national unity. The world looks to us for the vigor and for the vision that we have demonstrated so often in the past in great moments of our national history. And as I look down the road, I see a confident America, secure in its strength, secure in its values, and determined to maintain both. I see a conciliatory America, extending its hand to allies and adversaries alike, forming bonds of cooperation to deal with the vast problems facing us all. I see a compassionate America, its heart reaching out to orphans, to refugees, and to our fellow human beings afflicted by war, by tyranny, and by hunger. As president entrusted by the Constitution with primary responsibility for the conduct of our foreign affairs, I renew the pledge I made last August to work cooperatively with the Congress. I ask that the Congress help to keep America's word, its word good throughout the world. We are one nation, one government, and we must have one foreign policy. In an hour far darker than this, Abraham Lincoln told his fellow citizens, and I quote, "We cannot escape history. We of this Congress and this administration will be remembered in spite of ourselves. No personal significance or insignificance can spare one or another of us." End quote. We who are entrusted by the people with the great decisions that fashion their future can escape neither responsibilities nor our consciences. By what we do now, the world will know our courage, our constancy, and our compassion. The spirit of America is good, and the heart of America is strong. Let us be proud of what we have done and confident of what we can do. And may God ever guide us to do what is right. Thank you.
Now, delivering his first State of the World address, President Ford tonight has touched on many of the international trouble spots and issues, the Middle East, Cyprus, Soviet detente, trade, strategic arms limitations, more. But he put his emphasis, of course, on Indochina. He asked for $722 million in military aid for Vietnam immediately, plus another $250 million at least for economic and humanitarian aid, almost $1 billion in all. And he asked for Congress to act by April 9th. He said that the situation is, of course, urgent. He said the best chance for a political solution in Vietnam lies in stabilizing the military situation. That's why he wants the money. He also asked Congress to clarify its restrictions on using military forces in Indochina to evacuate Americans if that becomes necessary. He says he hopes it doesn't. And to extend that authority to pro-American Vietnamese as well. He said that he hopes that that isn't necessary. But he said did not ask for any more money for Cambodia, saying that By now, it may be too late there. Mr. Ford called on North Vietnam and the participants in the Paris Conference, among them the Soviet Union and China, urging them to use their influence to stop the war, says diplomatic representations have been made to try to achieve that. And now for some analysis of the president's address. My colleagues Eric Severide, White House correspondent Bob Schieffer, diplomatic correspondent Marvin Kalb, all of us having received some, about 3 hours ago, I think it was now, gentlemen, an advanced text of the president's remarks. Eric, the president asking for $722 million in military aid. Congress already reluctant to even give him $300 million. Do you think he's got a chance of getting any part of that?
Walter, one small item of correction. It's April 19 he wanted action by, not the 9th.
Did I say the 9th? It's 9 days from now, right.
The humanitarian aid, I don't think there's any question he'll get that. The military aid, this figure of $722 million is purely an arbitrary figure. Neither General Wayand or anyone else could go out there in that chaos and confusion in a few days come up with a very specific figure about units and specific weapons, I don't think. I'm sure they'd cut that well down, but there may be a number of people who really don't want to give any more military aid who will vote for a lesser sum in the expectation that there'll not be time to spend it, that this will be over anyway. They can tell their constituents they voted for it, but the result that in their hearts they rather expect will happen, whether this is done or not. I would think that's possible.
Bob Schieffer, the president also is talking about evacuation of tens of thousands of Americans or of Vietnamese who work for American agencies, governmental or otherwise, and also tens of thousands of other intellectuals who are pro-American and their families. It adds up to hundreds of thousands, perhaps. Does he really believe that there's a chance of getting that many people out of there?
Well, under some conditions, I think, Walter, they hope, first of all, that it doesn't come to that. But if it does come to that, they're hoping first that they'd be able to work out some kind of a negotiation or some kind of an agreement with both the South Vietnamese and the North Vietnamese to set up some kind of safe corridor so that these people would be allowed to proceed to ports where they could get on American ships and leave. But I'm not so sure that Congress is going to go along with the second part of this, because what the president is going to ask the Congress, he didn't spell this out tonight, but what he's going to ask them for is permission to send American troops, armed American troops, back into Vietnam. Troops who would have the right to protect themselves. That means guns, ammunition, it means artillery, it means air power. Because as officials in this government are saying, if you send them back, you have to have the whole nine yards. You have to make sure those troops can protect themselves. To evacuate South Vietnamese, and they're talking about a minimum of 100,000, perhaps 200,000 South Vietnamese. Some officials in this government are saying as many as a million may want to come out under such a plan, and I'm just not sure that the Congress is going to go along with that.
Marvin, we heard a lot before this talk tonight about the president wanting to use this speech to come out from behind the shadow of Secretary of State Kissinger and put his own stamp on U.S. foreign policy. Was there anything here that marks a departure from Kissinger foreign policy that you see?
Well, Walter, some of the words that the president used were clearly his, but I would suspect that the substance, the logic, the philosophy of foreign policy were all put together vintage Kissinger. But this should really not surprise anybody, because President Ford and Secretary Kissinger have had pretty much the same view of foreign policy in any case. And there might have been some effort on the part of a number of White House officials to drive a wedge or to suggest that there are vast differences between Kissinger and the president, when in fact, in substance, there have not been.
In keeping with CBS News policy of presenting differing viewpoints on matters of national interest, we shall also be hearing reaction of two groups of distinguished citizens, one of foreign policy experts outside the government, the other of members of Congress. And we're going to present a debate between supporters and opponents of the president's positions when our coverage of the State of the World message resumes.
Voices, other views. From Washington, CBS News correspondent Walter Cronkite.
Our coverage of some other views of the president's address tonight begins in New York, where Charles Collingwood has gathered several distinguished foreign policy experts. Charles?
Walter, watching the president in New York with me have been three gentlemen who are very specially qualified to comment and to analyze what the president has said. George Ball, former Undersecretary of State. William Bundy, former Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian Affairs. And Professor Zbigniew Brzezinski, who is Director of the Research Institute on International Change at Columbia University. Gentlemen, the President's speech was meant to be a major foreign policy document. Did you notice in it a new approach, a new departure in American foreign relations, Mr. Ball?
No, I would think he covered pretty familiar terrain. It didn't seem to me that there were any new, particularly new thoughts. What did strike me was the fact that, to a large extent, the speech was asking Congress to undo things that Congress had done or to do things that Congress had previously refused to do, such as the appropriation for Vietnam. I found no conceptual framework that seemed to tie the speech together in any novel way. It seemed very much familiar ground.
A new approach, Mr. Bundy?
No, I didn't think so. I think the speech was largely a checklist of things that have already been aired and that were before the Congress, many of them. Even on something like the Vladivostok Agreement, I missed his suggesting that we ought to try to go further than that and get nuclear weapons reduced in due course. There was almost a disinclination to go into new ground, and there certainly was no new concept. In a sense, I'd call it perhaps the last speech of the Vietnam era, not the first speech of a new era.
Professor Brzezinski.
Well, I would certainly agree with my colleagues. It seems to me to have been primarily a restatement of the policies that we have been pursuing for the last six or so years. No examination of what seems to me to be a rather fundamental transformation of world affairs that has taken place in the course of the last decade or so. No discussion of the new forces, no confrontation of the new problems, such as, for example, to mention just one, which wasn't mentioned at all, the problem of Portugal, not to speak of our relations with the new third and fourth worlds.
Why do you think he didn't mention Portugal, which has certainly been very much on the administration's mind?
Well, I was rather surprised. It seemed to me that if he was to discuss Europe, and especially if he was discussing the problem of the Middle East, he should have somehow addressed himself to the problems of Portugal. And that leads me to a further thought. Last fall, the president, in confronting a rather serious economic crisis, initiated wide-ranging consultations on the subject of our economic policy. I'm very sympathetic to the president's plea for unity. I don't think this is a time for recrimination, but it certainly is time for much broader, much wider consultations on the subject of foreign policy, not unlike those that he has had on the subject of the economic policy.
Mr. Ball, the president went out of his way to warn both friends and foes alike that the United States still is a reliable ally. Its commitments are still as solid as ever. Do you feel that warning was necessary, was desirable, or is true?
Well, I think it may have been necessary very largely because the president has created a situation in which it becomes necessary. In other words, I would say that the suggestions which have been coming out in rather constantly from the White House in the past weeks that American credibility is endangered as a result of the Vietnam fiasco and as a result of the congressional action and failing to appropriate money, and that people aren't going to believe us around the world, that this creates a problem of credibility which he is now trying to rectify. But I would have preferred that he not have created
it in the first instance. Mr. Bundy, the president has asked for approximately $1 billion, three-quarters of it in military aid for South Vietnam. Now, leaving aside the judgment of whether or not this is politically feasible, do you feel that it is
possible or would be helpful in the situation as it now exists on the ground?
The major thing I see in it, Mr. Collingwood, is what it will do to permit some kind of orderly ending of the war. In other words, I think we've been through something resembling the fall of France, and we're now talking about a Dunkirk. And while the president didn't put it in these terms, I read between the lines, particularly his emphasis on the 6,000 Americans that are there and not tens of thousands of Vietnamese who have, as it were, nailed their colors to our cause or the cause that was also theirs but have been associated with us, an emphasis on trying to get that accomplished. And that's very hard to judge whether this would have that effect. I think the psychological effect of providing some more aid might help to mitigate the very considerable danger that's been reported and that I would certainly see of the South Vietnamese taking out their frustrations against Americans on the ground. And I think that's something he must have had very markedly in his mind. I don't see it as permitting anything that would be an effective defense if you didn't have one before. I can't believe that you can shove arms to new forces, as they'd have to be, and really make that much difference on the military side.
Now, Mr. Schieffer, and indeed reading the or listening to the president's speech itself, indicated the president is going to ask for powers by the 19th of this month to give the United States the ability to somehow extricate not only the Americans, but those South Vietnamese who have been so closely associated with us as to be in danger. Is this in any sense, in your mind, a rationale for a new intervention by American forces in the Vietnamese conflict?
No, I do not see it that way, and I would be strongly opposed to it if it were.
Does anyone else see it that way? Do you?
No, I don't. I think that this is a genuine concern on the president's part, that he wants to have the power to intervene in situations where it becomes quite necessary to do so. But I would imagine that if the Congress grants this power, that they're going to wrap it around with a good many safeguards so that it can't be abused in the way that you suggest.
Well, that takes about a little bit longer than 10 days when Congress begins wrapping things in cocoons of safeguards.
Well, I'm not sure. I think that Congress will act on this very quickly.
Professor Brzezinski, do you think that it is possible for the United States or those others who share our concern for those Vietnamese who perhaps have risked their lives over the last 20 years being involved with the United States to absorb so great a number as might wish to leave?
Well, I don't really see that we have much choice. It seems to me that
we've taken a few thousand orphans.
Yes,
I was talking about
in a position, perhaps not quite that of Dunkirk, but of France at the time of the end of the Algerian War. The French had to resettle a very large number of people, in excess of 1 million. Of course, they were their own nationals, but they also had to resettle those Algerians who sided with the French. We have supported this war for better or for worse. We have made it our own. We have made some South Vietnamese line up with us. It seems to me that we have a moral as well as a political obligation to do what we can. In effect, as I see it, the president confronts three major dilemmas. One is how to alleviate the human suffering that is now going on, and in all probability will get worse. Secondly, to act in such a way so that on the international scene, the United States looks reasonably responsible. And thirdly, to act in such a way that whatever we do does not precipitate a divisive, bitter postmortem in the United States.
Now,
would be even more damaging.
Now, let me ask each of you a very rapid question, and I'd like a rapid answer. What was the positive aspect of the president's speech which impressed you most? Mr. Ball.
Well, I find it hard to see much that was positive in the speech, other than a general reaffirmation of many American concepts which have been in the public domain and a part of our policy for many years, such as a support for the Western Alliance, support for the Japanese Mutual Security Treaty, and so on. But I find nothing new.
Mr. Bundy? Like Mr. Boyle, I couldn't find anything very new. At least he referred to the new problems that are emerging that we've got to come to grips with. He didn't say anything any detail about such things as oil prices, which I think is a critical question we now face. I didn't find anything strikingly new in it.
Mr. Brzezinski, I'm going not to ask you that question because I think you share the views of your colleagues.
Sure. Thank you very much. Walter?
Thank you, Charles and gentlemen. For some varying congressional views on the president's address, Bruce Morton is on Capitol Hill. Bruce?
Walter, with me here in a room on the ground floor of the Capitol are three men of different political persuasions who at one time or another have been critical of some aspects of this administration's foreign policy. Senator Frank Church, a Democrat of Idaho, member of the Foreign Relations Committee. Senator George McGovern, Democrat, last time presidential nominee, also a member of the committee. And Republican and conservative Senator James Buckley of New York. Gentlemen, let me start because I guess it's sort of the headline out of this speech with the $722 million that the president asked for in additional military aid for the Chu government in Saigon. Was that a wise thing to do, Senator Church, and will he get it?
I think it's a very doubtful question that he'll get the military aid that he asked for. I think the humanitarian aid will be very much forthcoming. There's no serious dispute about that or about the obligation to the people that are now so desperately in need for that kind of help. The problem with the military aid is that there are many in the Congress who feel that it will just end up in the hands of the North Vietnamese, along with between $5 and $10 billion worth of weapons and equipment that have been abandoned to the North Vietnamese in the course of the last fortnight. So, it's going to be difficult, I think, upon more careful analysis of this proposal to persuade the Congress that this much additional military aid will really do the thing that the President hopes it will do. And in the extremities of this situation, many in the Congress will feel that we'll simply be turning over still more aid that will already, you know, make North Vietnam, once it accumulates all of this vast hoard of aid left in the field, one of the most formidable military powers in Asia.
Senator McGovern?
Well, I think Senator Church has put the case very well. There's an implication in the president's request for another $700 million in American military aid that General Tu is in trouble because of the lack of American support. That is not the problem. This regime is in trouble because of the lack of internal support from its own people, and that has been at the base of the dilemma in Vietnam these many years. If we were unable to stabilize the Tu regime with the presence of 500,000 first-rate American fighting men and an investment of $150 billion of American tax funds, who is to suppose that sending in another $700 million in arms at this point would add anything to the situation other than to the size of the captured enemy weapons that are already to the extent of $1 billion in the last few months. I quite agree that we have a humanitarian responsibility to do what we can with food and medical care and technical assistance of that kind, but no more military aid for Vietnam, please.
Senator Buckley.
I would say that the relevance of what we spent in the past is about the same as the relevance of what we've given Israel in the past after that equipment has been used up in wars with the Arabs. Either we're going to provide the South Vietnamese with the kind of military hardware that's required to enable them to defend themselves, and that's all anyone's suggesting. I don't know if that figure is $722 billion or something less or something more, but whatever that is, we ought to give. The alternative is that we will will either have to give substantially more in humanitarian aid to protect these people from the onslaught that will come down on them, or we won't be able to give any aid at all or deliver it because we won't be able to get into the airfields. But I'd like to address myself to these casual figures about the amount of equipment that's been abandoned. One-fifth of that equipment consisted of aircraft that couldn't be flown because we had neglected to pass on the spare parts that would allow them to get off the ground. I think we've got to talk about the existing situation and determine whether the United States will enable the people who have shown a desire to fight to protect their own independence and freedom to do so, or to abandon them to absolute destruction.
Let me just say that by such a proposition, the main difficulty I find is relating it to the facts. These figures that we have bandied about have hardly been casual. I had a briefing from the Pentagon just 2 days ago. I asked how much equipment has been abandoned in the field and how much of it is thought to have fallen into enemy hands intact, in good condition. I was told half of it. And when they gave the $1 billion figure that you used, Senator, I asked them, what is that based on? They said, well, not acquisition cost, which was between $5 and $10 billion, but their present estimate of the value of this equipment in its depreciated form in the field. So these figures that I've given are figures that I received from the Pentagon itself just 2 days ago. The other thing I want to say is there's a world of difference between Israel, in my judgment, and South Vietnam. The equipment we've given to Israel has always been employed by people who have not only been willing to fight, but they've been governed and they've been commanded effectively in the field. And they've had a fighting spirit and they've won their wars. The situation couldn't be more different than what we've confronted through the years in South Vietnam.
Now, just one further. It seems to me that in Vietnam we've been confronted with a situation of a civil war where you had one group of Vietnamese fighting for control with another group of Vietnamese. That is exactly the opposite of the situation that confronts us in the state of Israel, where you have a united people fully behind their own government, no real challenge to that government from within the borders of Israel, but being challenged from the outside. And under those circumstances, I think it's quite inaccurate to compare the challenge that confronts us in the Middle East with the one that faces us in Southeast Asia.
The other thing the President asked for in Vietnam was some legislation from you gentlemen which would clarify what I think most people see as a gray area in the War Powers Act, which would give him the power to send American troops in to guarantee the evacuation of American citizens and also of those Vietnamese who were on a communist blacklist because they had worked for this government or the Chu government. Is Congress disposed to do that? Mr. Buckley, first.
First of all, I'd like to suggest that the Fairness Doctrine has been violated. There's been 4-1 thus far in addressing these other problems. But I will address myself to this particular question. I believe it is to the extent that the War Powers Act requires this kind of action, obviously it is required. The first duty of a country is to protect its nationals. Secondly, I also believe that we do have that strong moral obligation to the people who we have placed in jeopardy by virtue of, whether rightfully or wrongly, we were in Vietnam, we did hire people, we did encourage them to fight for their own protection from, yes, other Vietnamese who happen to live north of the DMZ. And all of this business about the civil war and so on is kind of nonsense in view of the where the refugees have been streaming. But I do believe that we need to do what is required to make it clear that American planes can lift out refugees, Americans and others, that American ships can patrol the waters, that American Marines, if necessary, can land to assure the safe exit of these people.
Senator Byrd, the Democratic whip, said he planned to introduce some legislation and that would allow this at least for American citizens. Is there going to be any controversy about that?
There's no disagreement upon the responsibility we owe to American citizens in Saigon. I know of no ambiguities or difficulties in the present law that would prevent the United States, if necessary, to evacuate those citizens with a military escort. But if there is any problem
then we should examine it and correct it, because there's no difference among us as to that goal. I would say, however, let's be very cautious when we begin to tamper with this law, because I believe that the law is what's protecting us now from reopening another war in Southeast Asia. Let's be very careful if we change these provisions, not to change them in such a way as to permit a new occupation by American military forces of a very vague and indefinite character, particularly where we have South Vietnamese to bring out. The objective is one we all agree on, but let's be cautious as to how we tamper with the law.
Let me, we have just a couple of minutes left, try to ask you in turn about the broader implications of this. We were told in advance that this would be a Ford statement as distinct from the Kissinger statement. This would be the president putting his mark on American foreign policy. Mr. Buckley, if I may begin with you, did the president say anything in his speech to alleviate the more fundamental conservative misgivings about detente, about the relationship with China? Do you see any basic changes?
I see no basic change, but I was puzzled by one thrust of the situation. Since we have to protect detente, we have to assure there's a give and take and so on. I wish I could have been more reassured that we've had some give from the other side. I was gratified that he called upon all the signatories to the Paris Accords to do something about enforcing the provisions, which underscored the two major violators after the North Vietnamese, namely the Soviet Union and the Communist Chinese, who provided the North with the weaponry that made it possible for them to so flagrantly violate those provisions and mount the present massive invasion that has caused the South Vietnamese to have to retrench their lines.
Mr. McGovern, any new directions?
Well, I thought the one encouraging aspect of the president's speech is that he said it was time to stop recriminations against other Americans in view of the difficulties we have in Vietnam. I was very much disturbed on a recent trip to the Middle East to find our top leadership being quoted there and elsewhere around the world to the effect that because we were in trouble in Vietnam and because the Congress had seen fit to put restrictions on what we're doing in Vietnam, that no one could trust us. I can imagine our enemies trying to make that point, but it's appalling for the top leadership of our own country to blame the difficulties of General Tu on the Congress of the United States.
Senator Church, 15 seconds.
15 seconds. This speech had nothing new in it. It was a carbon copy restatement of Henry Kissinger's foreign policy.
Senator Church, Senator McGovern, Senator Buckley, thank you very much. Walter?
Eric, the president called for cooperation on the part of the Congress, a speech tonight. At least as far as his request for the $722 million, what we've heard so far in that sampling that Bruce gave us up there, and from a lot of press service dispatches quoting a lot of other members of Congress, it doesn't look like he's going to get it on that figure, at least.
I wouldn't think on that figure. That's terribly high and very arbitrary. But it also occurs to me that, Walter, that if the president's going to dramatize this whole issue of our credibility in the world in this high drama fashion of the speech tonight, and the Congress does not go along with very much of this, then having had it dramatized, surely our credibility around the world gets worse than it would have been. The business of cooperation with Congress and they with him, of course we need it. He is asking the Congress to join him and cooperate in a crash landing here. And the reason this is difficult is that they were not consulted and not brought in on the takeoffs. That's an old set of phrases from the Vandenberg-Truman time. They were not taken in on this growing commitment to Cambodia, which they were assured we had no commitments to, on the Paris Accords themselves, on whatever Nixon-Kissinger assurances in private there may have been to General Tu at the time of the Paris Accords 2 years ago. But I would think he has a very legitimate objection, and his requests about other things are quite legitimate.
Because this congressional backlash against the arbitrary conduct of foreign policy did lead to things like the Jackson Amendment on the immigration of Jews, on the arms cutoff to Turkey in the middle of a very delicate situation, on these indiscriminate trade penalties against some of the oil nations who should not have been punished, and on the whole business of trying to conduct a foreign policy as a great power on the basis of domestic special interests and ethnic groups. This is just impossible for any Secretary of State or President to do that very successfully. And I think you might get some movement here to roll back some of those restrictions in the Congress.
You know, at the same moment that he was saying that he wished to approach Congress with candor and a spirit of cooperation, he did, throughout the speech, several times, again, point the finger of blame at Congress, not directly, not in so many words, but by certainly indirection. And I wonder if Congress is going to find anything really conciliatory in the president's attitude now. They certainly got their backs up over his pointing the finger of blame specifically in the last couple of weeks.
Well, if they don't appropriate this money, or any military money, and things, of course, get worse, as they're almost certain to do, then what does he do with it? Does he keep on blaming them? Do they feel guilty? Do we have real recriminations all over the country? I don't know. I think if I were a congressman being very cautious, I'd vote for some of it, even if I were against the whole thing, believing, with some evidence, that there wouldn't be time to spend it.
Well, you know, I'm sorry. A number of high officials in this administration are making the point that the president did not ask for this money because he's expecting the Congress to turn him down. Now, this is the kind of language and the kind of promise that you'd obviously expect a high official to make at this point. And one could easily have had the impression, listening to the president tonight, that he was asking the American people, and in fact the Congress, to participate in a kind of charade. There is the deepest gloom at the highest levels of this government that the Saigon regime can survive. And what this money is really being asked to do right now is not to save Saigon, but to create an environment in which you can get the Americans out safely and perhaps some of the Vietnamese who have associated themselves with us. But I think that Mr. Bundy made the point before that this might have been the last speech of the Vietnam era, and one could certainly have had that impression as well.